Громкое дело о коррупции в Следственном комитете.
Трех высокопоставленных офицеров Следственного комитета России.
Операцию провели сотрудники ФСБ в здании главного
уже приняты под стражу взяты высокопоставленные.
Трава его подозревают в получении взятки в особо крупном
размере. Russia's main intelligence service raids its main law enforcement agency and arrests some of its top officials for links to organized crime. But it was pretty clear from the get-go that there was more than meets the eye in the FSB's dramatic assault on the investigative committee earlier this week. With Russia enduring an economic crisis, with an election just months away, and with Vladimir Putin shaking up the security services by creating his own personal Praetorian Guard, these are tense times for Russia's cops and spooks. So is yet another battle of the Siloviki on the horizon? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, an expert in Russia's security services and organized crime, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And joining us from Washington, D.C., also via Skype, is Karina Orlova, a correspondent for Echo Moskvy and a columnist for The American Interest, who has reported extensively on Russia's security services. Welcome to the podcast, Karina. Great to have you on.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. So we got a lot to chew on here. The deputy head of the investigative committee's Moscow branch has been arrested. The head of the Moscow branch's internal affairs department, as well as his deputy, have been arrested. And moreover, the head of the investigative committee's Moscow branch has reportedly resigned just hours before this raid. The criminal case in question is connected to crime kingpin Zakharia Kalashov, a well-known vor zakonia, or thief in law, also known as Sharko Molodoy, or Young Sharko. And now, given the close ties between law enforcement and the security services and organized crime, something like this only happens in certain cases, when somebody broke the rules or when some kind of a turf war is erupting. And this all is happening amid speculation that the powerful head of the investigative committee, Alexander Bastrykin, is on the outs politically. Mark, we're in your comfort zone here. Cops, spooks, and crooks. Unpack this all for us. Give us the larger context of what's happening here.
Yes, well, for what it's worth, I don't think we necessarily need to be sort of getting ready to have a whip round for Bastrykin's retirement present. It was definitely very striking. You had on Tuesday, you had this raid on the investigative committee offices. You actually have high-profile people being very publicly arrested, charged, their sins very quickly broadcast, not least, it's worth mentioning, on Life News, the ever-reliable FSB TV station. And so on one level, it's absolutely in the classic vein of the kind of that high-profile, shall we say, law enforcement political hit. On the other hand, I think for reasons which I can go into to later, I mean, I think that there are some other distinctivenesses. But just some dig in briefly on this business of Sharko Molodoy. This is a guy who had been released after several years of imprisonment in Spain, back in Russia, one of the heavy hitters within the underworld, and very much one of the kind of the more old style gangsters, not a delicate chap in a suit, but much more on the thuggish end of the scale.
And if I could interrupt you for a second, Mark, we were talking offline yesterday, and you were saying some suspect that he was behind the Diyad Hassan hit.
He may have been. I mean, that was one of the speculations, because he and Diyad Hassan, who, you know, had been one of the two most important Caucasus gangsters within Moscow, when he was murdered, it did certainly follow a very high-profile clash between him and Sharko Molodoy over claims that sort of basically a misuse of common funds, a so-called obstjak. This is the kind of thing which unfortunately sort of becomes a order of the day these days within the Russian underworld. But the point is, what you actually had is this guy who, you know, was not, shall I say, the most subtle of gangsters. By all accounts, he had agreed to pay $5 million to Nikandrov to provide protection and to make a series of criminal investigations relating to an attempt to shake down the Elements Cafe go away. He'd handed over the first installment of $1 million, wonderful round numbers these days. And that's what sort of, you know, gave the FSB the opportunity to strike. I think it's important. I mean, firstly, sort of, you know, Nikandrov has been something of a sort of an important prominent feature within the policing, particularly the Moscow underworld and indeed not so underworld. He was involved in the Yukos investigations. He was involved in a very bloody and frankly highly political case in terms of a series of underground casinos that were being protected by people from within the Moscow prosecutor's office. So, I mean, anyway, this is a guy who'd already been making a lot of enemies. And the interesting thing is not so much that someone like this gets arrested, because, I mean, obviously, until it's proven in a court of law, et cetera, we don't know the truth of the allegations. But having got through that boilerplate, I wouldn't be at all surprised, personally, if it were true.
Of course it's true, but the question is why they went after him for it.
This is the point. The interesting thing is when these people actually get arrested, rather than why, you know, have they committed the crimes.
And am I right in saying this only happens when there's a turf war or somebody broke the rules?
Or the rules change.
Mm.
Now, I know Karina has, I mean, because she wrote a really interesting article that actually, you know, with its own theory. So maybe hand over to Karina.
Well, yeah. Now, Karina, we're in your comfort zone here. I mean, you did, as Mark noted, have a fascinating piece in the American Interest this week where you linked this all to something of an internal fight within the FSB and the turf war between Viktor Zolotov, the new head of Putin's National Guard, and Investigative Committee Chief Alexander Bastrykin. And it is notable that Nikandrov, Maksimenko, Drimanov, the people who have figured in this, are all in Bastrykin's inner circle. So why don't you let us know what you've learned.
So, yes, I agree with Mark that the rules have changed, and that is what's going on. And so... how is Zolotov connected to the FSB? Some time ago, about a year ago or a year and a half, he entered, let's say, unofficially, the Sixth Service. The Sixth Service of the Internal Security...
The Internal Affairs Division of the FSB.
Yes,
yeah.
OSB, yes. This service, it's the most secretive service, and unofficially it's being called Gestapo. And so they started the economic security service, so,
of the FSB,
especially yes, within the FSB, and especially Directorate K, Department K. I don't know how you translate it in English properly.
So we have a battle between two parts of the FSB going on.
And they had, and the reason is very simple, because the shrinking economy, and because when a new player comes, he needs to take the territory. So that's why he starts to destroy people who control this territory, and he brings new rules. And so Directorate K is responsible for dog watching a financial sector in Russia. It's the most profitable sector in terms of what bankers and people in finance pay for the FSB, because it's hundreds of million dollars annually.
And Zolotov was basically the Krisha for this part of the FSB, so to speak.
He protects and he guards the Sixth Service. Although there were reports in the New Times that the Sixth Service is being protected by Sechin, which is simply not true. Sechin has nothing to do with that. How do I know that? Maybe you wonder. It's known, let's say, from victims, and there's been a lot of them, victims of this fight. So the fight between the USB and the SEB, Economic Security Service, ended with the USB win, with the triumph, because Voronin, the head of Directorate K, resigned, and his boss, the head of Security Service of SEB, resigned as well. And SEB was headed by the head of USB. So it was like...
So somebody who's loyal to Zolotov essentially got control of this at the end of the day, is what you...
This man's name is Sergei Kurilov. Kurilov is, if I'm not mistaken with his name. So he was appointed personally by Putin, which is very interesting. The head of the service, internal service within the FSB, is being appointed Vladimir Putin by the president. directly. And it happened 2 weeks ago, and they started their own game, their own play game. I don't know how to call it. So this attack on the investigative committee is the direct attack on Alexander Bystrykin, who was sent a message saying, Alexander, dear Mr. Academic, you are not, just don't call Putin. He is not going to protect you. We are the bosses here. And I guess the investigative committee official spokesman, Vladimir Markin, comments were pretty clear. They said that it's a shame that these so-called colleagues, what they were doing, and the self-purification work will go on, which was...
Yeah, his comments were uncharacteristically ramped down for him. He was not as talkative as he normally is. Mark, what's your take on this? Do you see the same kind of a turf war going on?
You see, I don't think I do. I mean, I think the rules have changed, but I think that it's from, as it were, further higher up. Because if anything, I mean, actually, this has been quite atypical. Bystrykin has been given, you know, the opportunity to sort of make it clear that he actually opened this case. This has not been sprung on him. And to be perfectly honest, given the involvement of the head of the Moscow Internal Affairs element of the investigative committee, it's actually entirely appropriate that the investigation of him would have been carried out by a different agency, in this case, the FSB.
So we're talking about Mikhail Maximenko here, the head of the Internal Affairs.
Yeah, exactly. Given his involvement, you know, you're going to need to bring in outsiders. The directorate that was actually involved in the investigation was Directorate M of the SEB, the FSB's sort of relevant thing, which is actually, again, it is the division that investigates government ministries and government agencies. I mean, Markin's public announcements, yes, of course, they've been fairly sort of low-key, but then again, who really wants to admit to having sort of rotten apples in your own thing? But the very fact he called it a self-cleansing, I mean, a self-purge almost. I mean, actually... We've seen a distinct lack of the usual kind of leaks to sort of shape and amp up the story, coming from, you know, sort of the other agency. The FSB doesn't seem to be crowing about its success and trying to put down the investigative committee. It's all being handled in a relatively decorous manner, which again is really quite unusual compared with these things. If this was the start of a turf war, I'd expect it to be being used much more enthusiastically. Two other points. One is, again, I mean, there's all this talk about Zolotov's influence. I'm still unconvinced that he has that kind of influence within the FSB, unless we're also talking about the head of the FSB being, frankly, crucially weakened. Because if Zolotov has control over arguably the most sort of important, certainly the most lucrative part of the FSB's operations, that's a major deal. But the second thing is, I mean, I think it fits into a wider pattern that we saw quite recently, for example, with a very high-profile purge of the leadership of the Baltic Fleet. You know, so much so that actually, despite their upbeat claims to the contrary, it's going to significantly impact the Baltic Fleet's operational capacity for at least a year while the new leadership comes in. They shake it down. They try and work out what the hell has been stolen and what hasn't, to which the answer is probably everything everything that wasn't nailed down is the honest answer. But again, I think what we're seeing is the quiet promulgation of a new set of rules of the game coming from higher up, in other words, the Kremlin. Which, very, very crudely put, is that you can be corrupt up to the appropriate level of corruptness. Or you can be incompetent so long as you don't embarrass the Kremlin. What you can't be is both. And what we saw, for example, was that in the case of the Baltic Fleet, they were both inappropriately corrupt, but perhaps most importantly of all, inappropriately rubbish at their job. And likewise, we now see within the Moscow Investigations Committee, not just something about Nikandrov personally, though clearly it was embarrassing and, you know, far, far too obvious, frankly. If you're going to take a bribe, for God's sake, I mean, this is more or less a sort of movie-type bribes. Times have gone on from since that sort of time. But more to the point, this was also a sense that the Moscow Investigations Committee also had to up its game. At the moment, as it were, it's being more exploitative and extortionate in what it's expecting from businesses, but on the other hand, it's, if anything, being regarded as being less able to do its job. So again, someone has to suffer. And in this case, I mean, I'm not convinced necessarily that Bastrykin was not actually part of the solution rather than necessarily the problem.
No, I would as a caveat here, though, Mark, I would say that the Nikandrov, Maksimenko, and Lamanov, the three who were arrested, as well as Alexander Drimanov, the head of the Moscow branch of the investigation committee, who reportedly has resigned. I haven't seen confirmation yet. They were all in Bastrykin's inner circle.
Well, yeah, but got to bear in mind, I mean, Bastrykin is unique amongst the head of the various sort of security intelligence agencies in Russia, is that he is the only one who actually formed his own agency. Everyone else inherited and therefore also had to inherit a fair number of people who were sort of their predecessors or their predecessors' predecessors' pick. So pretty much everyone who is in a senior position, especially in Moscow, within the investigations committee, you know, has a relationship with Bastrykin. That doesn't mean to say that either A, Bastrykin is going to go down, you know, with them. Of course not. That's not the etiquette of Russian politics. But nor does it necessarily mean that sort of he was up to now sort of protecting them or whatever. I think this is it. This is part of the art of being a good courtier in Putin's Russia, is to appreciate when the rules change and to change with them. And the thing is that Nikandrov and co, they clearly hadn't. What they were doing, quite frankly, a few years back would have been par for the course.
And it's not now because the pie's shrinking?
I think the pie's shrinking. There's also, I think, a growing sense that this is part and parcel of the way that the elite isn't really being properly patriotic, which means obviously obedient and efficient. And I think this is also part of a general shift towards, if I say a cleansing of the security apparatus, I don't mean that for a moment in the sense of honesty and so forth, but in terms of if they have, you know, very, very strong criminal connections, then the danger is that power begins to go where the money is rather than where it ought to be, which is coming from the Kremlin. So, I mean, I think for all these reasons, there is now sort of a process of, as I said, I mean, you know, I think a cleansing actually works in a term, because I think the Kremlin is now getting a little bit more worried about its situation.
Now, I'm going to come back to you in a minute on what's changing in terms of the relationship with the criminals. Karina, I see you seem to want to say something, so I want to let
yes,
you get in here.
I would like to disagree with Mark in terms of what he's saying.
I love it. We're disagreeing.
No. I mean, Mark is absolutely right if he's talking on a reasonable person positions. But unfortunately, a Russian security service and Russian system doesn't care about how business in Russia operates and how. So Mark said that the investigative committee methods became too hostile and they just don't allow to operate business as it should and so, which is, of course, it is true, but that's not of the FSB's concern because we just, I mean, the Russian media just don't write about what's going on. And if you take a look at what the FSB is doing to business, it's even worse. And this is true. They just destroy, they kill people, they destroy businesses, they put businessmen in jail. It doesn't make business operating better. And so the fight between the FSB and the investigative committee is not about cleansing. It's about redistribution, influence and power. And taking control over illegal activities that the investigative committee was in control of before. And also, I agree with Mark that Alexander Bastrykin will not be fired after this. Of course not. It's a message. And these guys from the Moscow branch of the investigative committee are just victims. And Jan Shakro, Zakhary Vorzhogonin, yes, Molodoy Shakro. He is a victim too. It doesn't, I mean, it, It could have been anyone. And so that there is a perfect question in your morning mails. It says, and given the fact that the case is connected to the mafia kingpin, what does it say about the changing relationship between the Russian state and organized crime?
Well, this is actually one of the things I want to get at, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. But now, just one more thing. So Vladimir Putin has always been known for his own so-called checks and balances system within his security services, within, I'm not talking about power divisions. No, it doesn't exist in Russia. I'm talking about how he's...
Among informal power groups.
Informal power. He always tried to separate them, to let them fight a little bit, not fight, but... to be competitors. But it seems that it's some of these groups became too strong and too, you know, too independent, as Alexander Postrykin, and too brazen, as he absolutely for sure is. So Vladimir Putin seems to, what I think is going on, that he's trying to put a system that Ramzan Kadyrov uses, highly centralized and vertical system, where there is just one power center, which is obviously Viktor Zolotov now, because his National Guard, it's a huge, huge power. And it's worth mentioning that army has always been not with the FSB, not within the intelligence, not within the security services. You know, it's just different. And so Zolotov has this huge part of the army, and both he has a lot of influence in the, inside the FSB, with the FSB. So this is what I think is going on with
So to sum it up, you're saying that Putin's moving from more of a system of balancing competing clan interests and letting them fight it out while he's the arbiter, to a more tightly centralized system that's yes. more vertical and more obedient.
Kadyrov system, very, very loyal, personally loyal. What Kadyrov has created, because it's obviously very successful for Kadyrov. And, you know, it's very reasonable, because why would Vladimir Putin keep this competition between his informal powers if he destroyed all the competition within formal powers? Because the competition, it always cleans the system. No. And it's very dangerous. And Vladimir Putin doesn't need any danger.
Mark, this is not necessarily inconsistent with the context you were putting here. I mean, that Putin is moving from more of a system where he's balancing clan interests to one where it's more of a centralized vertical system. No?
Well, I mean, I'm not convinced that there's necessarily this drive. I mean, let me just – I should actually just pick up – I mean, I didn't actually for a minute say that the problem with this investigations committee was that it wasn't allowing businesses to operate as they should, and that basically this was in some respects to make the economy work more smoothly. That's clearly not the case, and I agree entirely that the FSB is every bit as rapacious in its sort of dealings. But I think not everything is about economics. We can't understand every aspect of Russian power politics in terms of who gets to control which business legally or illegally. Power always trumps that. And that, so in this respect, I mean, I certainly agree that this is about power rather than just simply who gets to control a business here or there. But in that context, again, I mean, obviously it depends on whether or not you actually believe that Zolotov controls a large chunk of the Federal Security Service. Or a significant chunk of the Federal Security
And you don't
Service.
You don't think he does?
I don't buy that. He's not had that role. He's not had those contacts in the past. I mean, the same way as I mean, he doesn't actually control a large part of the army. I mean, the National Guard is separate. It's the forces from the Interior Ministry, not from the army. National Guard is significant, particularly actually not so much because of its soldiers these days, but because of the economic opportunities from Okhrana, the private security sort of arm of it. But still, I see no signs that, for example, it is superior in power and influence to the Federal Security Service itself. If all Putin had wanted is just one loyal henchman, in some ways it would have made far more sense just simply to put Zolotov in charge of the FSB and transfer the troops there, because then you have a ready-made structure which actually has a rather different and sort of more appropriate sort of operational culture for what he wants to do. Of course, this is difficult because we're all trying to kind of crawl inside Putin's head. and that's
just a scary place to crawl.
Well, exactly, and a very dark place, which is hard to shed any light. but I mean, I think though, I mean, we do see generally a certain kind of, shall I say, an intolerance. Not, and I really would want to stress, this is not for any kind of moral grounds. But, I mean, when I talk about an intolerance with certain forms of corruption, which, yes, is in part precisely because of the sort of the economic crisis in which the situation finds itself, but perhaps more importantly because of the knock-on impacts of that, which is actually therefore we have heightened struggles within the elite to grab whatever, you know, portions of this shrinking pie they can get. And also this is a regional dimension, that regional elites are becoming to be more and more pitched against the centre. So you might say as the tenor of competition increases, I think there are signs that the Kremlin is rattled. And one of the ways that it responds to that is precisely it wants to ensure that its security apparatus, which is the final backstop, is under its control. Now, we can dispute over whether or not the model is a continued sort of dynamic competition, or whether Putin genuinely wants to basically put all coercive power into the hands of one guy and trust in the loyalty of that one guy, which I think would be a very foolish thing to do.
Even if it's Viktor Zolotov? I mean, there's more loyal to Putin in the elite.
Well, I mean, in a way, but the point is, up to now, loyalty has been his only route to power. He has always been someone's deputy, someone's curator or controller, shall we say. Now, for the first time, he actually begins to acquire an independent power base, and perhaps most importantly of all, an independent Chornaya Kassa, you know, an independent source of money that he can then use to acquire clients and everyone else. We'll wait and see how long his loyalty lasts. Because there isn't the same kind of cultural dimension as there might be within Chechnya, though even then I think that's frankly over-mythologized.
I want to stop you for a second here, because there's an interesting parallel here, because in past podcasts, Mark, when we've discussed Vostrykin, his only currency, his only patron was Putin. He wasn't somebody who had other patrons in the elite. Vostrykin was kind of a lone wolf that way. Zolotov is very similar in that sense, right? I mean, he's pretty much alone. We got two of these rather unique characters within this structure, maybe or maybe not, at odds right now. No.
Well, if one buys the sort of there is a Zolotov Vostrykin clash, which almost
and you don't seem to buy that at all.
Beginning to get Oedipal. Well, I'm not seeing any signs of it bubbling out, and as I said, it doesn't fit with how I see the FSB operating. But you might say the interesting thing is, so let's follow this line. So Vostrykin emerges because Putin wants someone who has no existing power base, who is not beholden to other interests, more to the point, kind of can't call on others, as the sort of the loyal attack dog, which certainly was his role. Well, one could say, again, I mean, if one accepts his notion that he had become too brazen and so forth, that after a certain point, Putin wants someone who can indeed, if necessary, attack dog the attack dog, and along comes Zolotov. If one follows that logic, which I mean, there is definitely sort of truth in that, we can expect in a couple of years' time, assuming the regime is still in place, which it sadly probably will be, that Putin will be shopping around for someone who can control Zolotov. Because this is the natural dynamic of power in Russia.
Which goes on and on and on forever.
As soon as you begin to acquire that, you start to build your own networks of clients and allies and so forth. And also an increasingly paranoid ruler then begins to think he may not have quite the same traction over you that he does. So I think we should be wary of assuming that Zolotov, once loyal, is ever loyal.
Mm. Go ahead, Karina.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that you can see reports in the media, in Russian media, of the fight between Vostrykin and Zolotov. They have bad relations. Back in 2007, I mean, what I found just publicly, because I needed to just link it officially. I knew that, so there are even media reports. So this fight has been going on for, 9 years already. And talking about why would Zolotov come, you know, into the FSB, it's also what I was told by my sources is that there are not enough money in Russia, but obviously not enough for everything, every kleptocrat and every thief. So what they are doing, these law enforcement, Zolotov, National Guard, they were told to go to a self-sufficiency system. And they're just, that's why they raised stakes percentage for operations. They cover and they protect multiply. And I'm talking about.
So let's be clear what we're talking about. We're talking here about the extortion money that they collect from businesses.
Yes. Yeah, so if we're talking about financial sectors, the percentage of transferring money from Russia abroad were raised five times. So it's like a lot, right? And it happened about a year ago. And because they need money and they need to provide themselves with this money. That's why they attacked Sepp and Voronin. And it was very unexpectedly. Voronin seemed to be a very strong man. So not 2 months ago, or maybe 3 months ago, nobody could say that Voronin will resign, or he will be fired, actually. He resigned, of course, but it's, you know, and that's what they do. So, I mean, the reason why they are doing this is very clear. They just need money. It's as simple as that.
Now, see, I'm getting a sense that where the two of you disagree. I mean, Karina, you seem to see a almost a purely economic conflict here, a battle over scarce resources, where Mark seems to see a more politicized context. No, would that be a correct way to characterize this?
Well, when money comes with power, it is politics. No, so I guess Mark is right, and I'm right too. No, because yes, they're fighting over money and over power. Because if you don't have power, you don't get money. It's very simple. No,
Mark. No, actually, one thing I wanted to get at here, because I can think this is another thing that goes to the heart of what seems to be going on right now, is the changing relationship between organized crime and the state. Because prior, and we've discussed this many times on this show, the relationship between organized crime and the state was basically that you can, as long as you don't embarrass the Kremlin, no more public shootouts like in the 90s, and as long as you're ready to be called on for a favor when you need to be called on for a favor, then the gangsters can do their gangster things. That's changing?
Well, I think yes and no, as ever. You know,
you always want it both ways.
Like that. Exactly. No, I mean, I think, again, it changes in various levels. And one is precisely, again, this issue about the economic tensions. When it comes down to it, gangsters must know their place. Gangsters must know that, you know, the gangsters who have offices and suits and government drivers are the more powerful ones. And in fact, there's now a situation in which I think there's this, again, increasing competition, shall we say, between corrupt officials and the gangsters, whereas before there was enough money to go around. In the particular situation of someone like Shahro Molodoy, I mean, again, I think the problem is older style gangsters who don't really sort of appreciate the way the rules change and who aren't as closely connected in with the political elite are going to be at risk. It doesn't also help that Shahro Molodoy was sort of still connected to, you know, part of his power base remains in Spain, even if he's not. At the moment, because of the Spanish Troika investigation, which is a very deep diving and actually very audacious investigation being carried out there, that is coming closer and closer to figures linked to the Kremlin. I think there is a sense that the gangsters who operated in Spain were careless, and therefore they've pretty much used up their
political
margin
capital.
Of error, shall we say. Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, for all these reasons, you know, someone like Shahro is going to be at risk. So you might say it's not that the fundamental dynamic, I think, has changed. It's, you know, it's still the government is saying you can be a gangster but understand the rules. It's just that the detail of the rules are being revised on the fly, and some gangsters are either caught by that or else don't realize that.
So it's the old school Vori that are kind of being left behind here then?
There are no old school Vori left, even people who call themselves that. I mean, essentially, everyone has already adapted to that. But yeah, I mean, I think, the very back to go back to Karina's point, which is actually spot on, that the, you know, the real money is to be made from extorting from the banks and the financial sector, and ideally to be doing so from behind the facade of government agencies rather than sort of, you know, gangsters. I think what's happening is the center of gravity within the underworld is shifting further and further away from the sort of the embezzlers and so forth, so the extortionists and so forth, and towards the embezzlers and the corrupt and the white collar criminals. Shakro is still, he may not, you know, it's not necessarily, shall we say, the Vori world, but it's the blue collar gangster world.
Mm-hmm. So we're shifting from blue collar gangsters to white collar gangsters, so to speak. Would you agree with that, Karina?
Yes.
Okay. All right. All right. So, any last thoughts before we move on to the second section?
I think we just wait. The interesting thing is going to see how far Bastrykin can continue. I mean, you know, a key thing will be whether he is able to maintain control of the narrative, to put it in good political terms. At the moment, he's presenting it as we in the investigations committee realized we had a problem. We turned to our friends in the FSB who helped us out. And that's all very lovely and so forth. If he can hold this line for another week or two, then I think the signs are that he's fine. It's a question of how quickly we begin to see that begin to be eroded.
So things will settle down. Because one of the things I'm actually seeing in my readings of the reports on this is that the battle isn't necessarily always between or among services, but within services. So there's turf wars within the FSB. There's turf wars within the investigative committee. Karina, you wrote a bit about this as well, no?
That's a clarified. I mean, I'm not sure if it's still going on. I guess it is, because the new head of the directorate, K, has not been appointed yet. The guy instead of Voronin. And rumors were, as Erbica reported, was that Ivan Tkachev, who is now the Sixth Service head, might head the Directorate K. So again, the Directorate K is the most tasty slice of this pie. Yes, because they control financial sectors. It's tons of money, just tons. It's like bags of cash, really. And so that is why the fight is going on around this. And yeah, yes, there is the fight inside the FSB. I'm not sure there is the one inside the investigative committee. I'm not sure, because this structure doesn't
lend itself.
Yes, it doesn't make sense.
And Mark, you say basically if Bastrykin can weather the storm, stick to the narrative that the Kremlin has kindly allowed him to follow, that he's part and parcel of this investigation, things will settle down. We're not going to see another Siloviki war.
Well, I mean, I'm talking more about his own personal security. I mean, who knows? Again, I'm particularly struck because in some ways this is just another chapter in a long-running story. We also had the struggle for control of the Interior Ministry's economic investigations branch, which sort of led to, you know, high profile defenestration and so forth, which was clearly one that the FSB won. And in that case, again, it was interesting because one of the reasons why the FSB won is precisely that they were working, they had allies within the Interior Ministry. It wasn't just a straightforward Medvedev versus FSB struggle. These things are far, far more complex and nuanced than just the simple which particular acronym is competing with which other acronym today.
Well, on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at the lessons Turkey's failed coup hold for Vladimir Putin. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Karina Orlova, a correspondent for Echo Moskvy and columnist for The American Interest, who has reported extensively on Russian security services. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Из Турции пришло сообщение о состоявшемся военном
группа
перевороте.
Группа военных подняла мятеж против президента страны.
В стране объявлено о попытке государственного переворота.
Тем временем в Турции продолжаются кадровые чистки.
В Турции введено чрезвычайное положение. Оно будет действовать.
Last week's failed coup attempt was no doubt watched very closely in Russia. As the failed Turkish coup was unfolding and appeared initially to be succeeding, Ksenia Sobchak gleefully tweeted, "Watch how it can be with Erdogan as an example." And after the coup failed, Putin was quick to call Erdogan to congratulate him on restoring order. In a column for Bloomberg this week, political commentator Leonid Bershitsky wrote, quote, The projection of Turkish events onto Russia is only natural. Like Erdogan, Putin has appealed to Russia's conservative non-European values. Like Erdogan, he has consolidated personal power over a long rule unconstrained by constitutional term limits. Like Erdogan, he has moved to suppress the freedoms of speech and assembly and initiated tough anti-terrorism laws that make it hard to oppose him. And like Erdogan, he has struck at nonprofit organizations as foreign agents working against the regime. Besides, Russia, like Turkey, is a country where military and palace coups have taken place in recent memory. Given these similarities, what lessons can Putin draw from what just happened in Turkey? Mark, what do you think?
To be honest, I don't think that many lessons as such. Obviously, in Russian social media, they were having some fun tweeting out a picture of a grinning Sergei Shoigu with the caption, "Defense Minister learns army can change government." But Russia is a very, very different country. There are far more checks and balances, or at least control mechanisms, on the military. The military has a very, very different culture. It doesn't have a culture of being independently politically involved. And yeah, you know, I think the chances of anything kind of like a military coup in Russia are infinitesimal. If there is a lesson to be learned in the Kremlin, unfortunately, I think it's going to be as sort of play to an assumption, which is that basically the West is hypocritical, because as we now see Erdogan's kind of massively indiscriminate counter coup. Obviously, he's using this as an excuse for a huge purge, a real purge, of anyone who he regards as potential political opposition. And the West is clearly uncomfortable with this, but at the same time, really doesn't know what to do about it. I think, unfortunately, there will be a sense of, well, this actually proves the hypocrisy of the West. They will shout at us for, and again, this is just the Kremlin's perspective, you know, they will shout at us just because of, you know, one little dissident getting shot near the Kremlin. But on the other hand, look at what Erdogan is doing and getting away with it. So in some ways, I think not so much the lessons for Putin, but I think some of the wider implications of what's going on will actually be quite significant for Russia.
What about the lessons of the way the coup failed? Do you think Putin took anything away from that? I mean, because...
Well, I mean, I think if one can take anything away from that, it's that actually it says something about, I mean, if there's anything that the Turkish military ought to know how to do is to run a coup. And yet this was phenomenally badly arranged, which again also does suggest, as some have claimed, that this was actually a very rushed job because they actually heard that there was going to be a sort of potential purge of the officer corps and such like. It was a badly managed coup. If there are lessons for Putin, I mean, it might be that, okay, people power works, but you know, Putin is not a man, I think, to put his trust in people power and in mobilizing a population. That is one key difference between Putin. Putin wants to mobilize the population and maybe get them to a set piece rally to welcome him as the new president or something. But basically speaking, he wants actually a quiescent population sitting in front of the telly. Whereas Erdogan wanted them out in the squares. I think from Putin's point of view, the lesson is make sure that the military are never in a position to launch a coup rather than to turn to the population if need be.
There's a bit of an ironic thing here that Leonid Bryshitsky pointed out in his column is the way given the Putin's crackdown on foreign media and so on, Erdogan got his message out where? Through CNN Turk. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have CNN Turk, he wouldn't have been able to use that people power because he wouldn't have been able
to. Well, it wasn't
even
that. I mean, it's not even just that. I mean, also, you know, Erdogan had presented sort of social media and so forth as a tool of the devil until, again,
until
he
it
had
was.
FaceTime to actually get his message out. But again, I mean, you know, what does this tell us? This tells us that authoritarians are also often hypocrites. It's not really enough to hold the front page.
No. But in Turkey, where coups tend to be but from the military per se, in Russia, it's more the Siloviki broadly, if there's a fear of a palace coup. What lessons do you think those who might be thinking about a palace coup may have drawn from this at all? Because that's another thing that kind of crossed my mind, the fact and the way that this failed.
Well, I mean, I think, again, if one looks at... you know, how, I mean, and frankly, this dates back to Soviet times. I mean, they were always very, very well aware of the risk of what they call Bonapartism. And therefore, even if you just look at the balance of terror within Moscow itself, you know, you have two army divisions. You also have what is now the National Guards, Dzerzhinsky Division, plus Amon forces who are mainly riot cops, but you know, they've also gone and served in Chechnya and so forth. Plus, you have under, you know, separate command of the Federal Federal Protection Service, you have the Kremlin Guard, plus you have the sort of special forces of the FSB. So in other words, there is a whole interlocking array of different forces, which would make it very difficult. Whereas in Turkey, yes, there were the police, but actually, you know, the main sort of, you had the army and then the gendarmerie, which is the sort of the separate security force, which is controlled by the army. And in fact, you know, gendarmerie generals have been amongst those arrested. So in a way, I mean, the good news from the Kremlin's point of view is that actually the hard organizational work was done many, many years ago in order to ensure that actually this is a relatively coup-proof regime. Mm. If this happens, it's not so much likely to be, you know, this is not going to happen with tanks on the streets. Or if they are, in a way, they'll just simply be symbolic, just to reflect the fact that a coup has taken place. It's going to be, if it happens at all, like a successful version of the 1991 August coup. It's going to be that Putin is basically presented with a fait accompli, and the country is presented with a fait accompli. But to do that, just as in theory the 1991 coup plotters had, shall we say, a full set. They had the defense minister, they had the head of the KGB, they had the interior minister. And the point is, none of these were either able to control their own forces or, when it came down to it, sufficiently ruthless. So too, any meaningful coup against Putin is going to have a pretty full set. And that includes, going back to what we talked about in the first half, people like Zolotov, who are going to be a harder sell.
Does the National Guard and Zolotov change the equation at all in Putin's favor too?
Oh, God, absolutely, because it throws in yet one more agency controlled by an outsider who hasn't yet had the chance to get all kind of connected in with all the sort of the ties and sort of linkages of the others, who is definitely also a very different type of person. You know, Zolotov is basically, again, we go back to, it's very much like a Brit to bring class into everything. but, you know, Zolotov is essentially a blue-collar bullet catcher. Whereas actually the heads of the other sort of security agencies are, in some ways, they are security intellectuals. I mean, again, to greater or lesser extents, but they are people with cultural pretensions. They, as it were, they come from the middle and upper class, unlike Zolotov. And so I think there is also a division there. So by creating a whole new agency, putting a person who doesn't have connections with the other security elites, and indeed who may well have a bit of a chip on his shoulder and definitely feel separate from him, Putin has definitely, I think, made his regime that bit more coup-resistant. And therefore, I think that means he's safer in that respect.
Karina, any last thoughts from you on the lessons of the Turkish coup, the failed Turkish coup for Mr. Putin and those who may be seeking to do the same thing?
I would not lecture this brightest mind of all times, Vladimir Putin, about lessons. But what I want to say is that in February, I wrote a piece, a feature for the American Interest called Who Would Dethrone the Tsar? And it was about the elite split, which I say doesn't exist, actually, split up. Like fighting. There is no fight inside the oligarchs and businessmen and tycoons. But what I say, my conclusion is that if there is something that threatens Putin potentially is a coup. Not military, because military is army, is what it happened in Turkey, and in Russia it's Siloviki. I still consider that it really threatens Putin. People do not threat him. There's not going to be a people's revolution. People may come in the streets after the coup happens, if it happens, but not to, you know, to just kill the Tsar.
And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, an expert in Russia's organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us from Washington, D.C., also via Skype, has been Ksenia Orlova, a correspondent for Echo Moskvy and columnist for the American Interest, who has reported extensively on Russia's security services. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
It's been fun.
It has. It sure has been. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.